The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Acute and chronic leukemia is presented by Dr. Cheryl Kowalski.
All right, this will be leukemia and myeloproliferative disorders. So a lot of this is going to just be for your reference. When we think about acute leukemia or any type of leukemia, you got to think about abnormal proliferation of the cells. So normally it's all synchronous, it moves orderly, there's a feedback mechanism that works. But in leukemic cells, that feedback mechanism is lost. There's usually a genetic mutation that causes it, and these cells are released prematurely. In the classification of leukemia, we have two broad categories of acute and chronic, and then those are broken down into two categories of lymphocytic and then non-lymphocytic, except chronic doesn't have a non-lymphocytic, it's myelogenous, and I'll explain that when we get on a little further. So acute leukemia is a very diverse group of neoplasms. It usually arises from a transformation of uncommitted or partially committed stem cells, usually by genetic mutation. The leukemic cell abnormalities lead to this clonal proliferation of the leukemic cell, and then maturation arrest. It just doesn't mature, and that's why you see so many blasts. This also leads to affecting the other cell lines, either by crowding out of the bone marrow or the leukemic effect on these other cells. So you have an anemia, you can have thrombocytopenia, increased risk of bleeding, of course, infection, electrolyte imbalance, and in large high white blood cell count or blast count, leukostasis, and then invasive and infiltrative effects. So in acute leukemia, the symptoms are generally, for both lymphocytic and non-lymphocytic, a matter of a few weeks. And usually the biggest ones are bone pain and fatigue. So let's look at acute lymphocytic leukemia first. This mostly occurs in children. And it's worse prognosis with increasing age, especially over the age of 30. There's a bimodal peak where there's increase in patients over the age of 60. Some of these patients can have the Philadelphia chromosome, and we'll talk a little bit about this later. But if you recall, the Philadelphia chromosome is seen in chronic myelogenous leukemia. And so worse prognostic factors not only include that, but a total white count on presentation of greater than 30,000. There's no sexual difference, and it's very rare in the Black or African American population. So predisposing factors, irradiation early in life, some more inherited diseases like ataxia telangiectasia, mongolism. You can see sometimes a family history and if there's an identical twin. There's three classifications, L1, 2, and 3. You don't need to know this. This is just for your reference. And because this is affecting the lymph system, this you'll more commonly see hepatosplenomegaly or adenopathy, but not 100%, usually maybe about 50%. These patients are going to present with mediastinal masses, and if they do, it's usually a T-cell, ALL. And so when you see a mediastinal mass in a young person, and this may be a board question, think of two things, ALL or testicular carcinoma. Although we think that a lot of patients may have CNS involvement, it's generally, when you look at studies, less than 10%. But these all need to be worked up, and virtually any organ system can be infiltrated. So again, this is kind of more just for your reference. The CLL or CALA is more common in children, T-cell as they get older, and B-cell is pretty rare and doesn't respond to treatment very well. So good prognostic features is generally age 3 through 8, a white count of less than 30,000, less than 80% blasts, and if they can achieve a remission early. If there's no mutations, the Calla phenotype is the best, and female generally does a little bit better. So diagnosis, you'll see lymphoblasts in the blood smear. You need to do a bone marrow biopsy where you'll see lymphoblasts. And because blasts are kind of look all the same, it's virtually sometimes difficult to just visually tell the difference between lymphoblasts and myeloblasts. And that's where flow cytometry comes in handy, because it identifies little markers on those lymphocytes that help us determine what that is. And these patients also, as I said, need to have their CSF evaluated to rule out CNS involvement. So these patients are basically treated for about 2 years. The daunorubicin, vincristine, and corticosteroids are still the keystone, cornerstone of treatment of these patients. They'll always have CNS prophylaxis and different type of treatment, a little bit more intense treatment if they have CNS involvement. If they have the Philadelphia chromosome, they'll be treated with imatinib and or Gleevec, as you may have known more commonly. They'll radiation to the bulky areas, especially the mediastinal areas. And if there's any poor prognostic features or early relapse, stem cell transplant is considered. So let's move over to the non-lymphocytic leukemia. So the reason this is non-lymphocytic leukemia and not non-myelogenous, because it involves more than just the myelogenous stem cell line. And there's about eight, and they involve all your cell lines across the board. And again, it has to be distinguished from ALL because the treatments are different. And that's why they're divided into two different categories, because your treatment is different. And this is more common seen in adults, as we know. So this is your classification. So if you go down from M1 to M7, you can see that there is a difference. Although we start out with myelogenous, when you get to M4, we start involving the monocyte line, and then M6 is your erythroid line, M7 is your mericaryocytic line. And again, those are all pretty much treated with the same type of treatment. So what are your risk factors? Exposure to ionizing radiation or chemicals such as benzene, chloramphenicol. Exposure to drugs, especially alkylating agents and topoisomerase II inhibitors, like Kevin just talked about. Genetic factors, such as mongolism, which we talked about, Bloom syndrome, Fanconi's. And then myelodysplastic syndrome is a precursor, or can be a precursor for acute leukemia. So your prognostic factors are different than they are from ALL. This is worse if the person is over the age of 60, basically because they can't tolerate, most patients, the rigors of the intense treatment that involves. Of course, again, if they have a poor performance status. And if they have AML due to prior chemotherapy or some type of bone marrow disease. If their white count at the time of diagnosis is greater than 20,000. So again, signs and symptoms are the same, and they're due to the progressive penias that a person develops. In this case, they can get a hyperleukocytosis, and while this isn't common, if they do develop this, which is a white count of greater than 100,000, you can have blockage of the very fine capillaries with resultant ischemia, whether it's in the brain, kidney, lungs, and those type of issues that go along with that. These are also ones that can have DIC. So if you see that on board exam, most common one is M3, which is your progranulocytic leukemia. So progranulocytes, when you're having development of your myelogenous line, progranulocytes are the ones that start having granules in them. So when you lyse those cells, you're releasing all these granules with all this toxic material, and that induces a DIC. Typhlitis is an odd thing that can mimic appendicitis, and of course all your metabolic abnormalities, including tumor lysis syndrome. And then an interesting thing is your granulocytic sarcoma, most commonly seen in M5, which is your monocytic leukemia. And that's soft tissue involvement, which can affect anywhere in the skin. One of the interesting ones is also on the gum. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a good picture of that. And then CNS involvement, which is not very common. So this is granulocytic sarcoma. It's affecting the skin. It's these red nodules, and you'd see the same thing on the gums. You see these red nodules, and that's if you biopsy it. And it's important that they do be biopsied because sometimes infections, especially a fungal infection, can present like this. And so you need to know the difference. Is this a leukemic picture, or is this an infective picture? So the laboratory features, anemia is almost universally present, as well as thrombocytopenia, and though you can have some bleeding, generally hemorrhage is not common. Leukopenia with absolute neutropenia is fairly common, and of course leukocytosis is more common. And then our rods, although that's diagnostic of myelogenous acute myelogenous leukemia, you only see that in less than 10%, and that's what these look like. This is a monoblast, and it has these little stick figures in them, which are our rods. So when you do the bone marrow, you're going to see blasts. You're going to see decrease in your normal red blood or normal blood cell progenitors. And then you're going to get cytogenetics so that you can try to identify what type of acute leukemia this is, and then immunophenotyping with flow cytometry. So this flow cytometry will help or try to help distinguish between ALL and ANLL. Your most common subtype for ANNL is CD13 and 33. If you have 34, that's an unfavorable marker. And you can also have lymphoid markers expressed. And that's a biphenotypic acute leukemia, which can happen, although it's rare. So the treatment, of course, we have to stabilize the patient first, and this is where everybody in this room is important to the treatment of acute leukemia. We need every subspecialty to help us, especially our infectious disease docs, our GI docs, our nutrition staff, our surgeons that help, or interventional radiologists to put in lines. It pretty much goes across the board taking care of these patients. Supportive care includes appropriate blood transfusions, and broad-spectrum antibiotics, as is indicated, antiviral, antifungal, and that's where it's so important with our infectious disease docs to help us take care of these patients. So we still have the same treatment with these patients, which is the 7+3 regimen. It's 7 days continuous infusion, ARA-C, and 3 days of daunorubicin. And most of these patients will achieve a complete remission, and then post-remission therapy is with consolidative ARA-C, and possibly allogeneic stem cell transplant. We give all these patients the opportunity to visit the transplant center of their choice to be evaluated by this team of experts to determine, is this patient appropriate candidate for transplant? And then, if they are, to try to find appropriate donors. There is a shortage of donors. Probably less than 30% of the people who need transplant have donors that are available. And so it's important that if you're an active blood donor and interested in donating bone marrow, that you let your local center know that. If the patient has acute promyelocytic leukemia, they add ATRA, which is all transretinoic acid, with the chemotherapy. So we'll move over to chronic leukemia now. So chronic lymphocytic leukemia is the most common leukemia in the Western world. And median age is around 65. You've often heard it called the leukemia of the elderly, although I don't like to call 65 elderly anymore. Median survival is about 9 years. And they have increased morbidity due to problems with T cell dysfunction, lack of ability to make immunoglobulin, and the results of treatment. So diagnosis is by lymphocytosis, and that's when you guys find on your routine physical every year, you see a lymphocytosis starting to develop in these patients and send them over to your friendly hematologist who will try to help you make that diagnosis. to, usually they just need a flow cytometry initially to make that diagnosis on peripheral blood, but depending on where that patient is, you might move forward into a further workup, including a bone marrow biopsy. You need to make sure that these lymphocytes are have less than 55% atypical or immature, because more than that is more of a pro-lymphocytic leukemia picture. There's most of these are B lymphocytes, and they have B surface antigen as seen on flow cytometry of CD5, 19, 20, and 23. So usually, as I said, it's incidental finding a lymphocytosis, and most of these patients stay asymptomatic from time of diagnosis for long, long periods of time. So after long periods of time, we're hopeful. There can be signs of progressive bone marrow impairment with progressive neutropenia, hypogammaglobulinemia, which increases your risk of infection. You can see autoimmune phenomenon and Richter's transformation, which is transformation of a low-grade lymphoma or chronic lymphocytic leukemia into a more aggressive one. Complications can be Coombs-positive hemolytic anemia in 15%. Remember that a subcategory of your B lymphocytes goes on to become plasma cells, which makes your antibodies. And so this is why you're having so many problems with your antibodies. So not only can you have hypogammaglobulinemia, you can also develop dysfunctional ones, which can go on to cause the hemolytic anemia or ITP. This can also cause pure red blood cell aplasia and granulocytopenia. So the rye staging is still probably the most common staging. And this is probably, I think, really the only malignancy that truly has a stage zero. And that's just your lymphocytosis. And patients who just have that at time of diagnosis generally have about 12 years of life expectancy or greater at that time. Then we go on to intermediate 1 and 2, which adds your adenopathy and your splenomegaly. 3 is anemia, and 4 is thrombocytopenia. And you note with each addition, your survival time starts to drop. So poor prognosis, of course, as we just saw, is advanced stage at time of diagnosis, short lymphocyte doubling time. And so that's why when we first diagnose these people, we're kind of following them on a regular basis every 2 or 3 months, checking their CBCs with their differentials to see how fast those lymphocytes are increasing. If they have a diffuse pattern of bone marrow infiltration, advanced age is what you kind of think of. Sometimes males do worse. 17p or 11q deletion is a poor prognosis. High levels of beta 2 microglobulin and CD23. And then the CLL-PLL, which is that pro-lymphocytic leukemia. And then Richter syndrome. So treatment. First of all, we have to acknowledge that it's incurable. And so when you have an incurable disease, you have to talk about what is the best for this patient. Is it observation or early intervention? And in this case, early intervention is not always the best for this patient. When they just have a lymphocytosis, they could live for 12 years. But when you start throwing them chemotherapy at them and you're impeding their immune system even further than it already is, there's increased risk of infection and thereby death at younger ages when you treat them too soon. So observation is usually appropriate for most of the patients who are diagnosed with very early stage and asymptomatic CLL. So indications for treatment would be your B symptoms secondary to CLL, such as weight loss of more than 10% of their body weight attributed to that, not, you know, purposeful weight loss, night sweats and fever. If you have progressive bone marrow failure, so you're seeing signs of progressive anemia that's not attributed to anything else, a progressive thrombocytopenia with a platelet count declining below 100,000, not attributed to anything else, to starting to develop splenomegaly to the point where they can't eat very well, massive adenopathy, which may be painful. Those are indications for treatment. So when we're looking at the rise of the platelet count, greater than 50% increase over 2 months or doubling time in less than 6 months. Those are all things you have to watch for. It's kind of interesting. Sometimes these patients will rise from 5 to 10, 15, 20, 30,000, and then all of a sudden kind of stabilize. So you kind of have to watch them and know what patient, you know, what know the patient and what their comorbidities are before you decide you're going to start treatment. And then Richter syndrome, which we talked about, and development of hemolytic anemia or ITP. Sometimes those can be treated just as hemolytic anemia or ITP with high-dose steroids. If you don't have any other reasons to treat them with full dosages of chemotherapy, and they it may buy them some time before you have to start them on chemotherapy. So some of the treatments we have are alkylating agents, steroids, fludarabine, but probably the most common one we're using for all these is rituximab, and that's if they have that CD20 positive marker, then that they are candidates for rituximab. And most common treatment probably right now for these patients are combination of rituximab and the bendamustine. So hairy cell leukemia is a rare B-cell leukemia, usually seen in a bit older population, mostly in men, and it presents with pancytopenia and massive spleen. So if you have pancytopenia, massive spleen, put that in your differential. And these patients, generally when you go to do a bone marrow, have a dry tap due to a hypercellularity. So these are beautiful cells. So under a light microscope, the picture on the left shows those hairy projections from the lymphocyte, which is not always easy to see under light microscope. And so on electron microscope, you can see these beautiful flagellating fluffy things extending from the cell. It's diagnostic of hairy cell leukemia. So a blood test that you can get is the TRAP test. And then these are treated either with cladribine or pentostatin, and usually one cycle treatment with this, which is a continuous infusion of either of these drugs over 5 to 7 days, will usually induce remission in most of the patients. Moving on to chronic myelogenous leukemia. So this is a pluripotent disorder that affects all cell lines. And the cytogenetic hallmark is the chromosome, Philadelphia chromosome, the 922. And the molecular hallmark that they've been able to tease down to is the BCR-ABL. And this is 7 to 15% of most adult leukemias, and the mean age is in the middle age range. So most of the patients are in the chronic phase at the time of diagnosis. This is usually found on routine physical where you start seeing a leukocytosis. Just 5% are Ph negative or Philadelphia Crohn's negative. And most are asymptomatic at the time of diagnosis. So some may have a left upper quadrant discomfort or early satiety due to splenomegaly. And they may have unusual infections. I had one patient who was a young male, 23 years old, who presented with recurrent urinary tract infections. And when, after about the third or fourth one, the doc was treating, he got a CBC, and the white count was 400,000. So this is what the Philadelphia chromosome looks like. This is your normal chromosomes on the left, with the 9 and the 22, and then pieces of that chromosome exchange places, and that red mark is where that BCR-ABL merging takes place. So it's seen, as said, in 95% of CML, but as we talked about earlier, it can be seen in ALL, more commonly in adults, and upon rare occasion in AML. So CML has three phases, which is more prominent before the development of our medications like Gleevec. And we saw that chronic phase of 3 to 5 years, and then accelerated phase and blastic phase. So you'll do your routine physical exam, and lo and behold, find a large spleen. Your CBC differential shows mostly neutrophils, and bone marrow and cytogenetics is done. So the frontline treatment now is our imatinib, nilotinib, and dasatinib treatments. And then there are some newer medications that are coming out all the time for failure of these. While allogeneic stem cell transplant used to be first line of treatment for people under the age of 30, it's now a late treatment, and sometimes patient has CML 10 or 12 years before a stem cell transplant is considered. So we'll move over to myeloproliferative disorders. So first, myelofibrosis, progressive generalized reactive fibrosis of the bone marrow. And usually you find blood production in the spleen and the liver, which is called myelometaplasia. So these megakaryocytes release platelet-derived growth factor and other cytokines that stimulates fibroblasts. And think about it, that's scar tissue. And so your bone marrow is gradually developing all this scar tissue, and it's crowding out the good bone marrow so you can't make, so your good cells have no room to populate. About 50% are JAK2 positive, and there's generally no specific cytogenetic abnormality, and 10 to 20% can evolve into acute leukemia. So these patients usually present with weakness. They can have night sweats and weight loss. They usually will have massive hepatosplenomegaly, bone marrow failure, and interestingly, they can have portal hypertension and pulmonary hypertension due to that large liver and spleen. So on blood smear review, classic cells are teardrop erythrocytes. So you may initially have elevated blood counts, but then as the bone marrow is taken over by the fibroblasts, you'll start seeing the blood counts go down. So there's many thought to be etiologies, such as infections or hematological malignancies. Chemotherapy in the past, we have a brand new patient in our practice who had MOP chemotherapy for Hodgkin's disease in the late 80s, and now he has what appears to be myelofibrosis and bone marrow failure. So treatment can sometimes be hydroxyurea if you're needing to bring down the blood counts. You may need to transfuse as indicated. Upon rare occasion, you may do splenic irradiation if it has a very large spleen. Sometimes our JAK2 inhibitors, erythropoietin, can sometimes help. Androgen therapy, you can see it's a whole waste paper basket full of options that because there's no good treatment. Polycythemia vera, again, another myeloproliferative disorder, and these patients can present with signs of elevated blood counts. Predominantly, it's usually the red blood cells, and so you can see them having headaches, blurred vision, night sweats, pruritus after hot showers. You take one look at them, you can see the plethoric facies, you can see the red conjunctiva, venous engorgement, other issues. Sometimes they'll develop thrombosis or hemorrhage. So you're going to find them have elevated hemoglobin and hematocrit. Start watching your patients if they're starting to develop hematocrits greater than 48%. Some of us hematologists use the hematocrit to follow and treat the patient. Others are more comfortable using the hemoglobin. You see your red blood cell volume is increased. You will sometimes have a leukocytosis, sometimes a thrombocytosis. You do a bone marrow biopsy, it's hypercellular, and your erythropoietin should be low if your feedback mechanism is proper. If it's not low, then you have to look for something else going on. And remember, there can sometimes be more than one thing happening. And these patients, the vast majority of the time, are JAK2 positive. So to make diagnosis, you have worked up the patient, you know that they don't have sleep apnea, you know that they don't have bad lungs for whatever reason, and you get JAK2, and they're positive, no further workup is needed for this part. However, I have a couple patients who are JAK2 positive, but also are COPDers, and also have sleep apnea. So you have to make sure you're fixing all of those areas as well. So if they're JAK2 negative, then you've already done the rest of your workup. These patients are probably going to need a bone marrow biopsy for further workup. So you can think of your other etiologies of secondary polycythemia. We always think about renal cell carcinoma and uterine fibroids and hepatocellular carcinoma when we're working these patients up. But erythropoietin level is very helpful in that because these are malignancies that cause elevated erythropoietin, which causes your erythrocytosis. So, like I said, we're going to get a JAK2. If that's negative, then you'll proceed with your bone marrow biopsy and always do your heart and lung evaluation. So your therapy is to keep your hematocrit of less than 45%. If you have elevated platelet count, you're going to use Hydrea to keep your platelet count of under 400,000. These patients should all be on 81 milligrams of aspirin daily. And depending on the patient, these JAK2 inhibitors that are new medications out the past 3 or 4 years are sometimes helpful. So just thinking about thrombocytosis, I have another minute. So if it's reactive, it can be due to hemorrhage, trauma, post-operative. All these are listed. I would tell you we just had one in our intensive care unit who was severely ill, young person, no prior history of thrombocytosis. We had that documented on previous lab, and his platelet count went up to 1.2 million. These don't need treatment with Hydrea. Just treat the underlying disorder. The platelet count will come down. So an essential thrombocythemia. Many times these patients can be asymptomatic, or they can develop thrombosis or hemorrhage because they develop abnormal platelet function. We treat them, like I said, to a platelet count, get that platelet count below 400,000.